Welcome to Millington Baptist Church. The message you are about to hear was delivered at Millington by Dr. Peter Pendell.
Some of you have been in the place that I'm describing this morning. It was probably about 10 years ago, and I was standing in a walkway at Newark Beth Israel between two labs, cath labs. On the right-hand side, I could look through the window, and I was just about as far here to Eric, and I could see the patient laying on the table, the doctor leaning over him or her. And he had something that had stuck up through the groin area, came out all the way into the heart. And as you watched on the monitor, you could see that a dye, I learned later, was released into the heart. And through looking at that in films afterwards, which somebody helped, my brother-in-law helped me do, I could see where there was leakage between the valves. It was an amazing experience. Then I went over to this side, and this was just a walkway between two labs. And on the left-hand side, my brother-in-law is a cardiologist, and who was the reason why I could get in there. He was going like this with a wire in his hand. And the wire, you could see it flipping around on the monitor in the heart of the person laying on the table. And he was just moving the end of that pacemaker wire so that it would get into exactly the right spot. I was amazed. Just about fainted there in that walkway between those two cath labs. But I was reminded that the one on the right was assessing the condition of the patient's heart. The one on the left, my brother-in-law, had already assessed the condition of the patient's heart and was taking some remedial steps to help the patient live more fully and longer. And I have remembered that. In fact, I played golf with him the other day, and I was going back to that time. It was such an awesome picture of how we can do the right things in terms of our physical health. But it reminded me, as I've been talking about the heart, how there has to be times when we concentrate on assessing the heart, not the heart, the physical heart, like my brother-in-law and this other doctor were doing, but the heart in terms of who I am, the heart who is me, Peter Pendell. The emotional side of me, the inner side of me, more than just the things that I say and the things that I do and the clothing that I wear and the way I appear to people, but what's going on the inside becomes a very critical question to me if I want to maintain health in terms of my walk with Jesus Christ. We recognize the place of the heart in our lingo. We say he's heartbroken. You've said that when somebody breaks up with somebody else, or maybe you've said it about yourself. She's lost heart. You watch something on the movies, that was a heartwarming story. We all talk about the heart in the same way. And we need to be thinking about the heart in terms of relationship with God if we're going to be fully healthy and ready to walk with him. 2 weeks ago, I began to look at the subject of the heart, and you might remember that I defined the heart as the real me. My heart is the real me. It's not necessarily what I say, although as I'm healthy, then it's going to be together. What I say is going to be a reflection of the real me, and it will be my heart speaking. But too many times, you know as well as I do, that the heart is not reflected by what we say and by what we do, and we're living kind of with masks on them. But it's those unsolicited thoughts and unedited reactions and responses and, you know, when you get cut off in traffic and the words that come out of your mouth when you didn't guard them or think them through ahead of time is really a reflection of where your heart is and where my heart is. Jesus said that. He said it's out of the overflow of the heart that the mouth speaks. So he goes on to say you put good in, you get good out of the mouth. You put bad into the heart, you get bad out of the mouth because that's the way the heart functions. It flows, it overflows. The heart overflows through what we do and say. We found when we looked at the heart issue likewise that the heart is the place where the genuine work of God takes place. That somehow this word has to go down further than my head. And if it doesn't go further than my head, there'll be no conversion. There'll be no transforming work of God in my life. Just has to pass through that. I can study all I want. But if it doesn't somehow get to the heart, then it's not going to make the difference. And in fact, we saw that there's a way in which the Bible speaks of the heart and the mind and the soul and almost speaks of them as separate entities. But as you look at that very carefully, you recognize that the heart is still the foundational because it's the wellspring. The other parts of us have to catch up sometimes. Sometimes my words were out of bounds as a non-believer, and it took time for me to cleanse the words that I used, not because my heart was bad, but because I was in a habit of doing those things. That's the true with addiction I referred to last week. There may be some work that has to be done. In fact, there probably is for most of us in terms of addictions. After we become Christians, down the road a ways where things come back and we're relying on the old ways and we have to go after those, bringing the rest of us into line with what the heart is already come to. And the reason why this was such a crucial issue for me is, as I've said before, my heart was dying about 2 years ago, and I didn't know what to do about it. And I had all the symptoms of a dying heart that I talked about last week in terms of emotions and relational and spiritual, and I just didn't know what to do about it. And so I began to get some help and figure it out and try to understand it in terms of getting my heart back. But during those days, my passion had disappeared. My dreams had all gone down the drain. Any idea and excitement I had about life for the future was really absent during those days. And as I came to learn about it later, it was because my heart was dying. Other things were okay. I was getting a paycheck. You know, we had a house. I had a car. I looked okay from the outside, at least to most people. But people who knew me knew that something was wrong, Amy and Ilona in particular, but other people probably too. And that may be the same in your house. It may be true in your house. There's something missing. In fact, most of us, as I've studied this subject about the heart and losing heart and trying to recover your heart, I've found that it is very, very widespread. This is not just me. Over and over again, when I talk about the subject in private or in public, I find that people are saying, yeah, that's where I am. That's how I feel. And during the night, in those unedited moments, you wake up and you realize there's something more. This Christian life thing, there's got to be something more. It's not found in some experience with the Holy Spirit, I do not believe. It's not found in going to church more. It's not found even in studying the Bible more. There's something more. You know, Jesus promised us a fullness of life. He said, I didn't come just so you could make it through. I didn't come just so you could skip earth and get to heaven. I came so that in this life you could have a fullness that isn't available without me. And I'll tell you, when your heart is dying, that's what's missing. You know about heaven, you're going to go there, and you're glad you're going to go there, and thank God you're going to go there. But the travel between here and there, if the fullness is missing, is really a drag. It's very, very difficult to keep going. And so that was my experience. And so as a result, I found that in a lot of people when I've talked about it, you hear that voice, and there has to be more in terms of walking with Christ. I've said it before, I say it again, that a life without heart is not worth living. So I don't care what your degrees are. I don't care where you've been, how much you've done, how much I've done, what my degrees are. I want to live with heart and live out of my heart that's healthy in terms of being full of Jesus. And anything less than that is not worth doing. And I thank God that He has opened some of those avenues of understanding to me. Not because I was so smart. In fact, my degrees didn't help me and they failed me. But He's helped me see some things that I hadn't seen before. And I've come to understand what Proverbs says, that, boy, above everything else, you know, put everything else aside if you have to. Above all else, you guard your heart. Because if you don't guard your heart, that wellspring is going to be contaminated and it's going to dry up. So the heart. One of the best things we can do when we look at the health of our heart is to look at a healthy heart. And try to find out, all right, what's a healthy heart look like? And can I hold up my heart next to the healthy heart and see what it looks like? That's what doctors do. They know what the good looks like, and then they say, oh, wait a minute, you see this? It isn't like that one. It's supposed to be like that one. So then they take their courses. And the best thing I think we can do at this point in time with the heart issue is look at a healthy heart. And the healthy heart belongs to a Bible person, and it is the Apostle Paul. Of all people, the Apostle Paul has a healthy heart. Take your Bibles, if you would, and turn with me to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. I want to go to verse 7 through 12. We could go more in 2 Corinthians because it's Paul's journal. He really bears his heart in 2 Corinthians, as he does in no other place that I know of. And it's especially thrilling because you get a picture of his heart in the midst of what he's going through. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, start with verse 12. Let me read through this 7 through the 12th verse. Paul says, but we have this treasure in jars of clay, and the treasure is the knowledge of God and the good news of the gospel and the relationship with God. We have that in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. We are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed, perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not abandoned, struck down, but not destroyed, We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. For we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that his life may be revealed in our mortal body. So then death is at work in us, but life is at work in you. Remember a little bit about the church at Corinth. It's a very troubled church. It's just a disaster. When you say, boy, I wish we had a church like the New Testament churches, be really careful when you say that. Because a lot of them are in deep trouble. And the reason why a letter is written is because Paul or somebody else is trying to help with the troubles. And Corinth was one of the most troubled churches in the first century. I think largely because they got so proud of what they had that they became self-sufficient, whether it was their gifts or their talents. They just lived to draw attraction to themselves. And they attracted that kind of leader. And so they got leaders in there after Paul was there, and those leaders began to undermine the Apostle Paul. They said, Paul's not for real, he's not an apostle, he doesn't have wisdom, he doesn't have an ability to communicate the truth, he just is not good for you guys. And so groups of people in the church in Corinth began to follow the false apostles, and Paul was put on the sidelines. It's a very, very sad time for Paul, very heartbreaking. If you read 1 and 2 Corinthians, and there was a third letter to the church at Corinth, which we don't have, but it's referred to in the text of those letters. If you read those letters, man, you see a man who's weeping and who's brokenhearted because these people he cared about so much and gave so much to and invested so much in have turned away from him. And that's where the church is in Corinth. And Paul gives us in this passage and in a few others, especially in 2 Corinthians, kind of a peek into his journal. You know, a journal is something you write in about what's going on in your heart, or at least that's what we're talking about it as. It's your secret thoughts. It's not quite your diary about what happened today and the sequence of things that happened today. It's more about what's going on in the heart. That's what a journal is supposed to be. And it's almost as if Paul takes this journal out and says, here's what I'm writing in my journal, guys. And he doesn't just share it with you and with me. He shares it with millions of people because he's an apostle, and it gets written down in the scriptures. And you find out what's going on in Paul's heart. And it's sad. It's really sad. But you see in the midst of that sadness a healthy heart. And that's where you'll find a healthy heart most of all, is in the midst of sadness and difficulty. Because if the heart is healthy, you don't see it when times are easy as much because everybody looks fine. But when things are hard, that's where you'll see a healthy heart. It's like being on a treadmill. That's when the doctor will see a really healthy heart or a not-so-healthy heart, because the pressure's on. So it is with a healthy heart in terms of who I am. What do you see in a healthy heart? Let me just give you several touchstones. One thing you see is you see a man who is in touch with his pain, his disappointments, his sadness, his limitations. He is not hiding them. He says, we are hard-pressed. We are perplexed. This is the Apostle Paul who has the answers to a million questions. He says, we are perplexed. We don't know what to do. He says, I am struck down. In fact, I'm struck down on a daily basis. He says, death is at work in us. These are really hard times for Paul. But he doesn't give the plastic response that is so much a part of our culture and I suppose of his culture. Sure, everything's fine. You know, how you doing this morning? Oh, just great. Everything's fine. You and the family? Oh, yeah, we're doing really well. Since we got to the front door of the church, but not in the car when we came, of course, that was a different story. Yeah, I'm doing really well at work, except I've got an appointment with the boss on Monday that I don't talk about where I'm probably going to get canned or I'm going to get reduced in pay. So there is a plastic side of us, masks that we wear. And I don't know, sometimes I guess they're necessary or maybe we shouldn't say anything at all. But that's not Paul. He said, I am in excruciating times. I hurt all over the place. That's Paul. And that's a healthy heart. Second characteristic of a healthy heart is a person who with pain acknowledges and understands and appreciates the potential of pain. Theologies have been built over getting rid of pain. And I mean, they take verses here and there and they build all kinds of theologies over them that you can be rid of this and you can be rid of this. And go to the TV and you'll find lots of preachers who will say, you don't have to suffer like that. You don't have to do that. God doesn't want you to have pain. I just think they're way off track. I really do, when I look at the scriptures. In fact, I find a healthy man like the Apostle Paul seeing pain and saying, this is not fun, but this is good. This is how God teaches me. I don't learn very well when I'm in good times, but I begin to learn when I'm in pain because that makes me cry out to God for the lessons that he has for me. and a healthy heart sees the potential of pain. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 7, the passage in that I started with. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. Kind of a headline statement. Jars of clay, you know, that's the pottery. That's cheap stuff. When archaeologists go back through the ancient times, they find chips of clay and pottery down in the holes because it wasn't worth anything and it broke easily. So jars of clay are not what you would say, oh, this is what I'm really proud of, normally, until you realize that jars of clay allow God to be seen. When I have nice crystal vases, oh, that's something that attracts attention. If I'm a crystal vase in my mind, then you look at me. If I'm a jar of clay, Paul says, then you look at the source of power who works through me. So in the midst of my difficulties, I find that God is seen. Chapter 4, verse 12, then death is at work in us, but life is at work in you. It's almost the kind of picture that as I die, you benefit, Corinthians, and he says that in other places. So the death that I'm going through and the pain that I'm going through, this is ultimately used for the good of my people that I love so much. So this is good. Kind of boggles the mind. In fact, I was looking this morning before the services at 2 Corinthians 12, and it's even stronger there, and I wish I had thought of it for the slides. I didn't. Chapter 12, verse 10, Paul has gone through this thing about how he's had this thorn in the flesh, whatever that is. I won't try to figure it out. I'm not sure I can. But he goes to God three times, says, would you take this away from me? God says, no, not taking it. Goes a second time, no, I'm not taking it. Third time, no, I'm not taking it. My grace is sufficient for you, God says to Paul. So Paul in verse 10 says, that is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. See, that's the potential of pain. So the next time it comes and you say, oh God, rescue me. Say, oh God, don't rescue me before I learn the lesson you've got for me in this. That's the potential of pain. The third picture of a healthy heart in my mind is that it's a man who keeps pressing on. If you have your Bibles and you want to look at the buts with me in verse 8 and 9, it's just great balancing by the Apostle Paul. We are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed. Okay? Verse 8, the second statement, we are perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not in despair, excuse me. Or not abandoned. Struck down, but not destroyed. So what you get is this picture is not of a man who denies what's going on in the hurt of his life. That would be false and phony, and that's not true. But he acknowledges the pain that he's bearing. He sees the potential in it. And he says, by the grace of God, I will go on. I'm not going to be defeated about this thing. When the heart breaks, when the heart is going dead, you say, I want to escape. I don't care about anything as much as I care about getting away from this. That's when the heart's dying. That was my problem. I just want to escape. Get away from it. Not learn from it, but get away from it. Some of this stuff has made me nervous about retiring. When I was, my heart was dying, all I could think of was retiring because that was my escape. Now, I'm afraid of retiring because I've seen too many people who retire and lose their heart and just do everything they've longed to do for years if the money is available and golf full-time or fish full-time. Or eat food that's good for you, that's not good for you, excuse me, all the time. But just take it easy. And plan to do it for about 6 months to recoup, but it goes 6 months, 2 years, 10 years, 20 years. And there's no investment in the kingdom. So I'm afraid of retiring because I think my heart can go dead when I retire just as easily as it can when I'm overloaded. Okay, take that heart of Paul, healthy heart. You look at, you put it up on the shelf. You take your own heart, you put it next to it, you say, are they the same? Are those two things the same? And if you're like I've been, you say, no, they're not. Either I'm trying to escape from the pain, or I'm not seeing anything good that can come out of the pain, or this whole thing that I talked about that I'm not ready to press on, then you say, I don't have a healthy heart. Or there's weakness in my heart, and I can see my heart dying if I don't do something about it. And so I've got to go back, and what I'd like to do for a few minutes is to go back and see what's dangerous for the heart. Because something happened that got me to that place and gets you to that place. What are the threats to a healthy heart? What is it that can undermine a heart that was once healthy? Because when you became a child of God, you got a healthy heart. I did too. I was given a healthy heart. So what happens? What are the threats to that heart that was so good and rich and full, that knew something about the fullness of Jesus? What attacked my heart over that period of time? You go to your doc, and your doc will tell you, hey, you stay away from fatty foods and the Haagen-Dazs at night, and let me name some things I like to do, and sleeping in instead of exercising. And you know, the doctor will say, those are threats to a healthy heart. So what are the threats to a healthy heart when we talk about me and the inside, the center of who I am, my relationship with God and with my world? Be careful about judging my answers before I have a chance to explain them. When I say the mind can be a threat to the healthy heart. This thing right up here, inside the bone and whatever else is up there, can be a threat to the healthy heart. Now, that may sound crazy to you, but it sounds crazy to you, and it sounds crazy to me in part because we are part of an era, philosophically, called the modern era. And most of us were raised to be modernists. Now, I know you don't like that term, I understand, but let me explain it as it's used in terms of the lingo of the day. Because with modernism, the mind is king. We'll figure things out, and we'll get them fixed. Now, if that doesn't reflect you, cancel out here, but that really reflects who I am and the way I work. And maybe men are more modernist than women. I'm not sure. That could easily be. But when the mind is king and the industrial and the scientific revolutions come along, then everything begins to change. Let me just give you some things that we've concluded. We've concluded that if we can, well, I didn't, but people a few years ago concluded that if we can split the atom, then we can supply a source of power for people in deprived parts of the world, cheaper power in our part of the world. We can give them the clean water that they need, the food that they need, and we're going to have a wonderful world if we can just split the atom. Don't jump ahead. If we could map the human genome, then we can figure out why disease pervades and why it invades and what happens that the body breaks down. And we can fix the things within the architect of our physical body. And when we fix those, then we won't have diseases anymore. And boy, here's the ultimate. If we can clone ourselves, then I'll never die. Because when this body runs out, I got another one over there that's really the same as this one, only it's not worn out like this one. So if I can just clone it, that's modernism. That's thinking, if I can get it into a test tube, I'll be fine. If I can just think it through, everything will be okay. Well, postmodernism that we talk about when we talk about liquid or we talk about new generations, that sometimes has a bad rap, and like any movement, it has a bad rap. All movements have a bad rap. Every generation has its failures. But the thing that's caused modernism to come to the forefront is they've seen that that doesn't work. They've seen that that doesn't satisfy the soul, nor does it guarantee what's going to happen, even with all the mathematical equations and all the test tubes involved. And postmodernism has said, hey, wait a minute, the atom has been split and become a bomb. Yeah, wait a minute. And they know, as we know, that there are mad scientists waiting to get a hold of the human genome map, and they're going to create the super race, and the rest of us are going to be someplace else. So the very thing that was intended for good with the mind of man, isn't going to necessarily turn out to be good. And the cloning, I don't know a lot about it, but I know enough about it that I'm not sure I want to live in a world that's filled with clones. So rather than live forever, it may turn out I'd rather go right to heaven and skip go and not collect $200. Let me say something positive about the mind. The mind is a useful tool in submission to the heart. But it cannot operate apart from the heart and bring good. It is not the center of the person. It was meant to serve the center of the person. and the one who lives there. It is limited. It's limited especially in relationships. You know that as well as I do. The mind can protect us from heresy, and it can help us know our spouse better, but that isn't the same as loving God or loving our spouse. There's something more that's necessary. So don't get rid of the mind, and don't say, I'm not going to think anymore. That'd be crazy, because you'll go off in heresy, and you won't even know the people you're trying to relate to. So that's not the answer. Please, I'm not canceling the mind. I'm just saying that it has to be in its right place. The mind works with the study and do approach to life that I talked about a couple of weeks ago, but that doesn't work for relationships. You can collect facts about God, and you can become convinced that He is omniscient, He is omnipresent, and He is omnipotent, but your heart will not be changed until you come in contact with that God. You learned everything about Him. Something more that's got to happen if it's going to be the transforming work of God. Relationships take time, and they take effort. It is easier to collect information than it is to relate to people. Or to animals. Forgive me. In college biology class, they gave me a cat, and they say, you've got to dissect this cat. Now, those of you who love cats and think they are the next thing to humans, forgive me for that. That's what they gave me. I cut that cat apart. The doctor told me how to cut the cat apart, or the professor, what to look for, what to find there. I knew all kinds of things about that cat, but I didn't know that cat. I had no relationship with that cat. Doesn't surprise you, does it? Because relationships are more than information. Here's another way to describe it. There are two ways to describe the truth of a kiss. Okay? One way is with the mind. A kiss is two sets of mandibles pressing together for a certain duration of time. Makes you want to get one, doesn't it? I'll take three. It's true. It's exactly what's happening. You can look at it from front to back and back to front. It's exactly what a kiss is. But when you describe a kiss from the heart, you say, oh, there's a vast world of difference, isn't there? That's all I'm talking about with the mind. Don't get rid of the mind. Don't stop going to school. Don't shut off your mind. But remember, there's folks like me who went to seminary, and during the years that I was in seminary, my heart was so divorced from the facts that I had to learn, and sometimes I allowed that to happen. Sometimes I didn't know how it happened, but I was very much in the focal point of what Jesus said when He said, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. And anybody who studied the Bible intently knows how much that can happen. So take care of your mind. The mind is the gateway for the heart, for the person. So you can't get rid of it. You can't be sloppy with it. But don't think that it's the end of the picture. The mind can be a terrible threat to a healthy heart. Here's the second thing that can be a terrible threat to a healthy heart. Duty can be a threat to a healthy heart. And again, don't misunderstand me. I'm not against General MacArthur's duty, honor, and country. Duty is not evil. It is not wrong. It's just that underneath it, I'm going to have to be, for the long run, motivated by my desires. If I am only motivated by my duty, I won't go for the long run. I may have the form of going, but I'll never run the race the way God has intended for me to run the race unless the desires match the duty. I think you can see this too, as I can see this. You have to choose a surgeon for an operation. You see two docs, and their reputations are sterling, both of them. The one doc is a doc because his dad was a doc, and his dad was a doc, and his dad was a doc, and he was expected to be a doc. So he went to school. He went to the very best schools. He's written up in all the periodicals and journals. He has just got such a reputation, but he doesn't like his job. And he doesn't like his job because he's tired of it. He's doing it out of duty. He doesn't want to do it anymore, but he's got the kind of lifestyle now that he has to have the job to support the lifestyle, so he continues in the job. That's choice A. Choice B is a young woman doc whose family never went to college, let alone to medical school. She worked hard. She loved biology in high school. She just got a dream of being a doctor, so she went to college, and then she went to medical school, and now she's practicing. And she hasn't been to the best schools, but she loves medicine. And she'll study like crazy for your particular surgery. In fact, she serves people who can't afford to pay her because she just loves to do it, and she loves people. I'd take her any day. I'd put my life in her hands any day. Why? Because the heart is together with the mind. and she's not living out of duty. And I know that she'll give me everything she possibly can. Duty is the default for us. You know, when the heart goes cold, you just revert to duty. You just do. When I first became a Christian, my friend said, you need to have a daily quiet time. So I said, great, I have a daily quiet time. How do you have a daily quiet time? And he told me, and so I began to have a daily quiet time with Jesus, and it was rich and full, and it was wonderful for a while. And then I don't know what happened, but someplace in the time as it passed, it became a duty. So now I do devotions. Isn't that a funny way to talk about devotion? I do devotions. That tells us how far our lingo is from what Jesus wants it to be. I do devotions. Instead of meeting with Jesus, I do devotions. And if you do devotions long enough, you won't do devotions anymore. Because you won't do it forever. I guarantee it. I don't. If it's not a relational time with Jesus, I may do it out of duty because I know I have to and I need to report to you that I'm doing my devotions. It ain't going to last because duty takes over, and duty is a threat to the heart. If duty is your primary motivation for what you do in life, whether it's your job or it's your marriage or it's your relationship to God, it isn't going to bring you joy and it probably won't last. The third picture of the threats to the heart is repetition can be a threat to a healthy heart. I know I'm in the traditional service. Please, I'm not nailing anybody. I'm just saying, I know what repetition can do for me, can do for you. It has a way of being deadening. Now, I know that traditions are important, and families need traditions, and churches need traditions, and I understand that repetition can be good, but we even speak of repetition when it gets to a deadening effect as being mindless repetition. That's not because our minds aren't connected. It's because our hearts aren't connected. We say mindless because we can do it without thinking. It has become so much a part of our minds, we don't need our minds to put us into gear to do it. But if the heart is lost from the repetition, it becomes mindless repetition. And it's no good for us. Too much repetition makes us comfortable. It makes us secure. But it also puts us to sleep. The mind and the heart are threatened by too much repetition. For you, for me, no matter what it is. That's a problem with an assembly line. You know, that's the weakness of an assembly line. You put cars together on an assembly line, and you don't get the same car that you get with a Bentley because that's not on an assembly line. People go to sleep on assembly lines in church, at work, at home. And somehow repetition does that to us. I no longer cast stones at liturgical churches with their repetition. I have no right to judge whether or not that's tied to the heart or that's mindless repetition. I don't do that anymore. And one of the reasons I don't do that is because I recognize that we Baptists have our repetition too. Sure we do. And it too becomes mindless. I mean, I become so used to something being a certain way that if it's changed, I just go haywire. It ruins my day. It certainly cuts out the effectiveness of what's going on in other parts of whatever it is, a service or an event or whatever it happens to be. Jesus is supposed to give us a new name, and he's supposed to give us a new song. I hope he's ready for the battle. When we say, I got my name, I don't need a new name. I like my songs, I don't need a new song. Amazing Grace was good enough for Paul, it's good enough for me. I say that laughingly, but it's really tragic. Because it will put me to sleep, and my heart will be disconnected. Sometimes folks say change for a change's sake is no good. I'm not so sure I agree with that. Sometimes I think change for change's sake is a part of the routine of the way I say I love you to Ilona, or the way I do church, or the way I have my quiet times with Jesus. In fact, here's a theory. I don't know if this is true, but you can tell me from your own life. A business or a ministry ought to be thinking about the next way of doing it when they're approaching the top. And our problem is, in business and in the church and in our personal lives, is we think about the next way to do it when we're sliding down the other side and we miss the curve. And the smart business and the smart church and the smart Christian says, this is wonderful, but it can easily die. I've got to move on to the next one. Repetition is dangerous. Life without heart is not worth living. That's the theme, really. That's the issue. We'll come back next week. I want to talk, or in 2 weeks, we'll come back, and I want to talk about recovering your heart, what you do when you recognize that your heart is dying. I would encourage you to do all kinds of things different this week. Just see what it feels like. You know, if you're married, find a different way to express your love for your spouse. I'm really putting myself on the line, and Ilona's going to be looking for a different way. That's okay. If you're used to sitting on this side in church, go sit on that side. You know, maybe after the first hymn, we'll have everybody who's willing change sides, you know. I'll preach like this, you know. No, really, I'm not kidding about that. That's a good idea. But really, in the next time, before we talk about it again, take your heart, put it up there next to Paul's heart, and say, what's that look like in contrasting the two? And if there's something missing, it doesn't have to be a major failure or a major defect. It just has to be, I'm not as healthy in heart as I need to be. Then your next stop is Jesus. And your next stop is Jesus crying out to him with the words of the psalmist, search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. For the glory of God.